Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
NVIDIA grows by more than $200 billion, all in a day's work. You're listening to Motley Fool Money. I'm Ricky Mulvey. Joining us now is former NVIDIA shareholder Jim Gillies. Good to see you on this day of all days.
Ah, you're gonna stick the knife in right to start, are you, Ricky? Okay.
I think you got some knives to stab back. This morning, investors cheered NVIDIA's place in the AI race. NVIDIA builds graphic processors, and the company made $7 billion this quarter. But analysts really liked the guidance. NVIDIA expects an extra $4 billion in sales next quarter. Jim, what went through your mind when you saw that the stock gained a full McDonald's today?
Yeah, I should clarify a couple things. One, I think I sold my shares in 2010, so it's been a while, and they were part of an option strategy that doesn't look too good now, but I did lack a crystal ball at the time and still lack one today. And also, too, is it NVIDIA or NVIDIA? Maybe it's a Canadian thing. I've always called it NVIDIA, but... Anyway,
NVIDIA. I've heard both.
I'm kind of curious. But yes, what went through my head? It's a fantastic quarter. Really was. I am not much of a tech investor. I think a lot of people know. I think most tech, there's facets of a lot of business models that make it difficult to pick long-term winners. I sound kind of Berkshire-esque, I think, on that one. Not that I'm opposed to owning some, but I think that there's also some valuation concerns that sometimes come to play, and I think would suggest that sometimes is with us with NVIDIA today. I don't think I've ever seen a guidance revision or guidance update like they gave for their Q2, where I think analysts were broadly expecting the mid $7 billion in revenue, and as you say, they were saying, oh no, we're going to do $11 billion. We're going to add four to that. And of course, the stock is up about 30%, I think, this morning. And that's great. It really is great. But my take on that is, look, NVIDIA, fantastic quarter, fantastic company. I think the longs, people who own it, should rejoice today. I think it's really great. But just be cognizant of what today's price, and I did this work before the market opened, so it might be slightly different, but it's roughly right. Before last night's beat and raise, NVIDIA was already trading at 39 times sales and about 20 times EBITDA. Incorporating in last night's results for cash generation, it's trading for about 190 times the last four quarters, including last night, the last four quarters free cash flow. So what that means is if NVIDIA started today, well, this little thought experiment, started today to pay out, say, we are going to have a dividend policy of paying out 100% of free cash flow. And remember, free cash flow is the money that's left over after the company has paid all of its bills, made all of its capital expenditure choices. You know, so this is money that it has in theory to pay out as dividends, buy back stock, make acquisitions, pay down debt, make additional kind of growth-oriented CapEx things. There's not many more things you can do with free cash flow. But assume that NVIDIA wanted to pay out 100% of its free cash flow. It would take you 190, it would take you two centuries basically to get your money back. I don't like your chances of making it to the end. Now, of course, the big glaring thing that I'm omitting there is the potential for growth, right? And that is why people are willing to pay 190 times free cash flow for this one. I very much think two things are true. One, NVIDIA is not about to start paying out 100% of its free cash flow. That's just as a construct. And the second thing is, I'm reasonably sure there will be some growth here. I think the open question is how much growth, because the way that investors are pricing this thing, they are pricing it to be a multi-trillion dollar company in the not too distant future. It could get to a trillion this week, frankly, on market cap basis. And do you want me to go down I could go down a little bit of a history lesson here, or
let's go down the history lesson, okay, of tech adoption cycles for, I'm rocking with NVIDIA.
Okay.
Because I do think we can occasionally learn a couple of lessons from history, and especially the boom of the early .com and internet cycles for a lot of those tech companies.
Right. Yeah. So I've looked at the last couple years of COVID, kind of COVID craziness, the rise of SaaS, the rise of AI, the rise of a lot of these tech things. I've kind of said, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme, kind of thing. I thought the last few years have been not dissimilar to the tech bubble and the tech wreck of, say, circa 1997 through 2002, which I had the fortune or misfortune, depending on your point of view, to invest through. I was a young investor, so I think I learned a few things. I hope I learned a few things through that experience. And kind of my framework today is I've kind of looked at these things as, I call it the tech bubble stocks. There's four categories. The garbage, that went to zero, ignore it. The stuff that was fine, it was fine. But a lot of the stuff that was fine, because it was only mediocre and fine, it got to such ridiculous valuations. And today it's down, you know, 80% from all-time peaks, or it took so long to climb back. The third category is kind of my most interesting, where I spent the most time. As I call the generals, the guys that were setting the tone for that era, the companies that you couldn't miss, fantastic companies, and they're all by and large good companies, right? But it was a valuation thing. So Intel today is Intel. The four I like to call the four horsemen are Intel, Cisco, Microsoft, and Qualcomm. Intel and Microsoft basically owned PCs, which was the hot tech trend of the day, right? I suppose you could throw Dell in there as well, but let's talk Intel and Microsoft. In everyone, Intel today is down 60% from its all-time high set 23 years ago, and that is after bringing out a dividend, raising it every year, buying back about 40% of their stock, you know, never recovered. Cisco, which was the router king with some new thing called the internet is going to take over all facets of our lives. Cisco down about 40%, never from its all-time high, never recovered. Again, same drill, dividend, raise a dividend annually, buy back 40% of the stock. A long-term shareholder from there is still down. Microsoft was dead money for 16 years, really only is recovered because of Satya Nadella kind of taking the reins at the company and going in a different direction. They're the gold standard of the big four generals that I talk about, whereas they have returned about 7.4% annualized before dividends since their peak in 2000, which is fine, but you know, you could have got that with less risk by buying an index fund. And the fourth one is Qualcomm, who had a royalty on every new mobile phone sold at that time. Qualcomm has given a non-dividend adjusted return of about 15% since 2000. Not 15% annually, Ricky. 15% total. Thanks. So that's category three, the generals. So the garbage, the fine, the generals. And then the fourth category, I call it, is Amazon, which is, you know, just of course been its own thing. I think it's very safe to say NVIDIA is not bucket one or two. It's not garbage, obviously. It's not fine, obviously. I hold that they are general. So then the question becomes, where in this cycle are we buying NVIDIA today? Because I lack the ability to go back and buy it at last week's prices. Maybe there's some time travelers out there, at which point call me, but I don't have it. I think it's a bucket three. I think it's a general. So where are we buying it? If we're buying the general in, say, early 98, late 97, that's much better than if we're, but are we buying it at the 99, 2000 peak? That is a problematic. I think my own, I tend towards, I think we're buying a general earlier in the cycle, but that valuation, just be aware, fools, if you're going to be buying NVIDIA today after what was a really, really spectacular quarter, be prepared to put it away for 5 years. Don't look at it. Don't put, you know, 20% of your portfolio into it. Take the time to say, okay, I am buying this high quality company for the long term, and I'm not going to get spooked if margin compression, say, takes us down 50% in a year or two. I'm here for additional gains, and I also recognize, you know, the limitations of large number investing. As I said, Ricky, this is probably going to be about $1 trillion company or $1 trillion market cap by the end of the week. It looks like if it triples from here, it's the largest company in the world, and I don't like those odds very much. But others' mileage may vary.
Yeah, I think this is also, for me at least, a somewhat difficult company to understand. NVIDIA expects a lot of their growth to come from data center usage with mm-hmm. those large language models and generative AI. Those are the words. I still think that a lot of the business is incredibly technically complex, at least for me. This makes me kind of put it in the too hard bucket, at least for me, Jim. Let's move on to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, to a more, I would say, Jim Gillies company, and that is Best Buy. A retail electronics store where shoppers are slowing down on big ticket purchases. We've seen this at Walmart, Home Depot, Target as well this quarter. For Best Buy, comparable sales growth is down 10% from last year, but management affirmed full year sales guidance of about $44-ish billion. What were your big takeaways from Best Buy's quarter?
Oh, I'm a little hurt. Yeah, I'm going to point out I did own NVIDIA at one point. I've never owned, to my knowledge, Best Buy, but, you know, it was a Jim Gillies company. But no, I think the through line I would give you from NVIDIA to Best Buy here today is this idea that companies should know what they are and investors should kind of buy into knowing what companies are. And so the Best Buy quarter, it was perfectly decent, given what this company is. They beat expectations, which were low because, of course, the world's slowest moving recession has been giving so much fear to people for at least the last, what, 4 or 6 quarters now. There's, of course, also the longstanding general fear of Best Buy being Amazon's showroom and unnecessary in the present era of retail. They did affirm their outlook for the year, but they also mentioned that they are seeing inflation hitting household budgets by, as you mentioned, buying less electronics and what have you. Here's the thing about Best Buy that I look at, though. They bottomed about a decade ago. They bottomed about $12 coming into 2013, and meaning they have been about a six-bagger since they bottomed a decade ago, and that's before dividends. If you assume dividend adjustments, closer to an 8-bagger, and it bottomed because of the perceptions that we have today. That is, Amazon showroom unnecessary. People can, you know, they sell commodity goods that we can buy pretty practically anywhere. And yet, Ricky, over the past decade, Best Buy has produced just over $17 billion in cumulative free cash flow. They've spent about $4.6 billion of that on their annual dividend, which they have tripled the cumulative payout over the decade. Dividend per share has gone from 68 cents a year to $3.68 a year. That's a 5.2% yield today. They spent $10.3 billion in buybacks over the last decade, shrinking the share count by 36%. They spent another $1.4 billion in acquisitions. We'll assume those have been intelligent acquisitions. May or may not be reasonable. And the rest of the cash is piled up on the balance sheet such that you have a balance sheet with nearly $1 billion in net cash today versus a balance sheet a decade ago with net debt of about $500 million. And what debt they do carry is relatively long-term and low-cost. So what I talk about, know what companies are, understand what they are, I look at Best Buy as basically a no-growth, perpetuity-like cash cow, okay? Revenue last year was about 46 and change billion. Revenue a decade ago was just under 42 billion. That's about 1% growth. So I think my low growth assertion is fairly valid. But management teams have recognized that the value for this business is as a cash cow and not as a growth engine. So they've managed it as a cash cow. And that's how you've gotten market smashing superior returns from Best Buy over the past decade out of all companies. Can that continue? I believe management will probably try. I think a reasonable, you know, if you think, and again, they've done about $17 billion over the past decade in free cash flow, call that averaging $1.7 billion a year. If they could do $1.5 billion a year, the current valuation is 10 times that cash flow. Okay, you're going to get your 5%, 5.2% dividend yield. And with the combination of increasing dividends, because again, they've raised it every year practically and done a good job. They've grown it 18% annualized, the dividend that is, over the past decade, plus maybe taking down 3 or 4% of the shares per year, which is, again, what they've been doing for the past decade. You know, I think that probably gets you north of a 10% total return annualized from here. Now, is that good enough? Or is it just easier to go indexing? That's for investors to decide. But I will point out, I followed the Best Buy story for a while, in spite of never owning it. And look, if you were taking bets a decade ago that Best Buy would be a six bagger before dividends over the next decade, I'm reasonably certain you would not have gotten many takers. Because again, the story was Amazon showroom, it's unnecessary, fails the snap test, as David Gardner would say. And I hold that can still be a beautiful setup if you understand what you're buying.
And with Best Buy too, I think Corey Barry pointed out in the quarter, which I found, which I appreciated, is that the demand drivers are still there.
Yep.
Yes, people are spending less on big ticket items, but all of those laptops and TVs that people purchased over the pandemic, those get replaced every 3 to 7 years, and your Best Buy showroom will be there for you.
Exactly.
Jim Gillies, always appreciate it. Thank you for your time and your insight.
Thank you for the invite, Ricky.
Before our next segment, got a heads up for Stock Advisor members. A new episode of our premium podcast, Stock Advisor Roundtable, just dropped on Spotify. Tom Gardner and the team talk about managing risk and some mid-cap companies that they believe have a bright future. Check out the show description for a link. Next up on this show, we've got some more tech talk. DigitalOcean is a cloud services provider that focuses on developers and small to mid-sized businesses. But is it doing anything differently than Microsoft Azure or Amazon Web Services? Motley Fool analysts Tim Byers and Mei-Lin Quinn caught up with DigitalOcean CEO Yancey Spruill to find out how it's retaining larger customers and standing out in a hyper-competitive landscape.
Here's what I want to get to, because you're certainly known for simplicity, and that is interesting. I want to get to some of the things you're doing as you scale up. But before we get there, can we talk about how you get those larger customers? I'm just looking at the release here, and what you said. Let me make sure I have this right. But the percentage of customers who are spending at least $50 a month, is that now 43%? Yes, 43% of the what you call builders and scalers, customers spending more than $50 per month, that increased 43% from the first quarter of 2022, and their revenue is up 32% year over year. So what are you doing to get people to stick with DigitalOcean instead of getting to a certain size and then say, I'm ready to graduate to AWS?
So it's really important that we were built day one to serve the idea generator who wants to launch that into a business. And what we've learned over time is adding features and functionalities, layering support, supports customers on their journey. We've also learned some things about product. One size fits all, as you said, with the container, does start to run out as customers grow beyond $50, $250, $500 with the scalers. And the reason we launched the premium dedicated droplet is precisely that reason. We learned that for bandwidth intensive use cases like media or streaming businesses, they need a different configuration than a standard amount of compute, network, and storage, the relationship that we have conventionally. And so we tailored that for that business. So how we've been able to scale with customers over time is we're tailoring the capabilities. We've added load balancers. We've added other bandwidth products. We've added other variants of Droplet that does flex to a scaling need. We've added databases. You know, once you go from X number of customers to Y, you can't use a whiteboard anymore as a startup to talk about your customers. You need a sophisticated tool to use digital tools, and so you need a managed database. Once you go from one or two engineers writing all the code to 10, 20, 30, you need different software deployment models. Kubernetes, serverless are helping with that. So we've added capabilities over time so that as a two-person startup goes to a 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 or in some cases, hundreds of employees we have on our platform. You know, as your number of employees grows, your workflow gets more complex. Software helps to make that less complex. So we have more tools that I just cited. We also have a marketplace. And then and the same with your customers. As your customers grow, you need other tools on the compute side, on the infrastructure side. So we've been able to scale that. So we've made it such that, you know, if you looked at our largest customer today, started as, you know, a handful of people around a computer terminal in 2014, spending 10, 12 bucks a month. And, you know, now that's a nearly a $200 million revenue business with hundreds of employees. Cloudways, who we bought last year, was a customer, started in 2014 at 10 bucks a month, and you know, grew to spending with us $1 million a month when we their last invoice when we acquired them last summer. So, so we've created this flexible model, and we have support. And this, I can't overstate this enough, in that support and documentation, our tutorials, our community, they help people who don't have. You know, they can't call IT on the eighth floor or call DevOps on the fifth floor and say, come up here and help me with this problem. The product has to stand on its own. And when it doesn't, the documentation, the investment we've made there, and support, every customer gets support, regardless of price point, is critically important to help them on the journey. Because we have lots of customers who come to us from one of the larger players or even smaller competitors who don't have that commitment to support, and it's a differentiator for them because it's like a force multiplier, because they'd rather invest their marginal dollar in some sales and marketing or their product, their customer relationship. They don't want to invest it in core team when they can get it embedded in the product experience with us. Those are all the ingredients for how we're able to get people lift off when their idea is ready for liftoff, and support them through large levels of scale on their journey to, you know, realize their aspirations as to be entrepreneurs.
One thing that's always impressed me about DigitalOcean is its high net dollar retention rate. Just seeing that customers are spending more and more on the platform, I think really speaks to the value that DigitalOcean provides. And I'd love to chat about new customer growth. With so many companies like, you know, Microsoft, AWS, just continuing to lower the prices of their services, I'd love to chat a little bit about, you know, the competitive landscape. Where does DigitalOcean sort of fit into this, and how does it differentiate itself from other cloud services providers that also target small to medium-sized businesses? You've already kind of touched on this, but would love if you could share.
First, the market for what we call SMB cloud, and this is per IDC, is $100 billion a year today. So it's a massive market. It's not as big as the enterprise cloud market, which is several times that, but this market's very big. It's very fragmented because there's 100 million small, medium-sized businesses in the world. It's 30 million developers. Collectively, those two groups spend the $100 million in cloud spend today, so it's very fragmented. So how we attract people to the platform is through our tutorials. We have tens of thousands of documents online. That generates 10 million or so visitors to our website a month. And we offer that for free. And whether it's, how do I do this on AWS? You can come to our site and get insight into that, let alone how to do things on DigitalOcean's cloud. Many people come to our cloud to read our tutorials and learn how to program. I've met a number of people who are running businesses on our platform today who first came to us because we had a tutorial that helped them learn how to program in a certain language, and then they played with that for a few years and ultimately launched the business. So we germinate people early on, foster their learning and their growth, and then we support them. That's very differentiated, the fact that we have the documentation, the support. You know, we're an open platform. You don't have to customize your software app to our proprietary platform. We're simple, easy to use. In the time we've been here, frankly, in the first 5 minutes that we've been on this call, you could have signed up and been coding on our platform. In the time we've been on here now, you could have read a tutorial and then signed up. So it's very simple, easy to use, and then it's cheap. You know, it's really value priced, which we're proud of that, and we intend to maintain that differentiation. And so what that does is it allows us to attract people who don't yet know what they're gonna do. We call them learners. They come to the platform and they just stay here. And they may stay here, I think, on average for 4+ years before they may or may not launch a business. We like to, that's fine for us because it's super low acquisition cost to get them here. We write the tutorials once and they're read millions of times, so it's really low acquisition cost. They don't consume, the use case in the early stage ideation stage, you don't consume a lot of compute. So it doesn't cost us a lot to serve them. And we're going to have that compute anyway to serve the builders and scalers, which are 86% of our revenue. So it's a really low-cost acquisition. I said it on the call the other day. It's the world's best lead generation tool because they pay us to be leads. And then we're getting smarter and smarter at identifying earlier and earlier who's a high-potential user, who has high intent, and then we're helping them with get there sooner so that they can get above $50 as a builder or $500 as a scaler. We use $50 as a marker because, you know, above 50, you are doing more than just a hobbyist or figuring things out. You actually are converging on running a business, building a business. And so that's how we differentiate, is we're here for the journey. We're not here for the $1 million only customer a month. We're here for, come here, the average customer starts at 18 or 19 a month through self-serve. We're about identifying, creating this place for them to figure things out. That's what we call community, huge commitment of ours. And then we help customers along the journey so that they can reach their aspirations faster and get into that builder and scaler. And that's why we're feeding the builders and scalers. Why we've been tailoring our disclosure over the last several quarters to talk only about them or principally, because that's what's fueling the business. But we need the learners. We need that large pool of people who come here, don't spend a lot, not sure what they're gonna use, how they're gonna use it, and incubate them and foster them so that they, when they're ready to explode and launch, we're there to serve them. And then the applications scale to, you know, you could build a $1 billion business on this platform. And that's very unique. That's how we're differentiated from everybody else in this large end of the market that's SMB.
As always, people on the program may have interests in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Ricky Mulvey. We'll see you next time.